Welcome everyone to the March 2018 edition of the Football Scholars Forum. We are joined by Andrew Downey, author of Dr. Socrates, footballer, philosopher, legend, and Dr. Chris Gaffney, who will be moderating the session. So without further ado, I'll pass it over to Chris.
All right. Well, thank you, Peter and Alex, for hosting another lovely event. And a special thanks to Andrew joining us from Sao Paulo, where he's just witnessed Brazil beat Russia in their lead up to the World Cup this summer. And when I first suggested that we, that Football Scholars Forum start turning to biography, Andrew's book, of course, sprang to mind, one, because it's hot off the press, two, because it's excellent, and three, because it's a long overdue examination of one of the most iconic footballers in Brazilian football history, but also one of the many global icons that Brazil has created in the footballing world, and a figure that was is perhaps ever more relevant in the Brazilian context as the fine threads of democracy peel off the shirt of Brazil, and we're looking for new symbols and new leaders in a situation where democracy seems ever more fragile there. And so I wanted to introduce Andrew to the Football Scholars Forum, one, because he's a passionate footballer, a fanatic Hibs fan, and we've had, he and I have connected over football, through football, and because of football over many years. And so this book, Dr. Socrates, is a welcome contribution to the literature. It is a timely intervention and a much overdue one. And so Andrew is has been in an excellent position to write this, as he's been in Brazil for 16, 17 years, maybe longer now. Andrew, you might have lost count by now.
Yeah.
And is incredibly well versed in both the realities of Brazilian football, its cultural importance, and the particular role that Socrates played in the Corinthians democracy movement, but then also as a public figure later on. And so with that, I would like to turn it over to Andrew to talk a little bit about his motivations for approaching Socrates as a figure, as an icon, and to tell us a little bit about the process of writing the book and how you see this, what you've produced as fitting in with a larger literature about Brazilian football, but also how it informs us about the contemporary conjuncture in Brazil.
Chris, thanks very much. Thank you for that lovely introduction. Thank you also to Peter for inviting me, and thanks for showing the interest. It's great to be here, and I hope not to let you down. I'll say just a quick few words about myself, and a quick few words about, you know, the book, and then I'll leave it up to you to ask more specific questions, and I can get into more detail on the issues that most interest you. I'm from Edinburgh, I'm from Scotland. I left school when I was 16 and worked in a factory for 7 years as an apprentice electronic engineer. I was the worst electronic engineer in the history of energy. I realized that was not what I wanted to do. I wanted to go and see the world and travel. And so I bought a ticket to, it was originally from London to New York, out and back from Rio to London, with the idea that I would go over land between New York and Rio. And it was just going to be 6 months in Latin America, which is what I'd really always wanted to do, and wanted to end up in Rio. To cut a very long story short, I ended up in Mexico City, got a job as a journalist, spent 3 years in Mexico at the beginning of the 90s. I went to Haiti, I lived for two years in Haiti, came back to Mexico for 4 years, and then I moved to Rio in 1999, and I was in Rio for 8 years. I've now been in Sao Paulo for 10 years, and in almost all that time, the last 28 years, I've been working as a journalist and as a foreign correspondent, mostly for US publications, some British publications also, but more because I appeared in almost, you know, all the newspapers that you've heard of, and a lot of the magazines. Sometimes, you know, as a stringer, a regular stringer, and sometimes just as a one-off. But I round about 2012, I was working. I was a foreign correspondent for Time magazine, but Reuters came along. Journalism was paying less and less. It was more and more of a struggle, and Reuters came along and offered me a retainer to write about sports and sports business, which was perfect for me because it was right up my street, and it was also great timing because they wanted to spend more or give more attention to football and to the business of football, particularly 2 years before the World Cup. So that was really perfect for me, and I dropped all the other stuff and started working for Reuters. And around about October 2014, when the World Cup was over, I was really looking for a project to get my teeth into, because I'd been doing the same journalism for a long, long time. And having been in Brazil for 15 years at that point, the same stories were coming round again. It was the same violence, it was the same corruption, it was the same problems, all interspersed with the occasional uplift and peace. And it was all interesting, but it had reached the point where I was doing the same thing over and over. So I was looking for this project, and I had always been interested in Socrates. I had always been interested in football. As a fan back in Scotland in the 1980s, I hitchhiked across Europe once, back when it was still communist. I hitchhiked through the Low Countries into Germany and all the way to Vienna, and then took the train to Hungary to watch my team play. I also went to the World Cup in Italy, went around seeing all kinds, as many games as I could. I went to the World Cup in France, and I went to the European Championship in 1996, which, if any of you are much younger than me, you'll probably wonder what team I was watching. But the shocker is that Scotland used to have a half-decent football team up until about the end of the 1990s, and I would go and watch Scotland. So I was really looking for this project, and I found it in Socrates. He was a man that always interested me. I followed Brazilian football, obviously, from afar, for all the same reasons that everyone follows Brazilian football. I knew who Socrates was, and I became more interested in him when I came to Brazil. Particularly, I translated Rui Castro's biography of Garrincha from Portuguese into English in around 2004, 2005. And when that was finished, the same publisher asked me if I would be interested in translating another book. And I said, sure, what book is it? And they said, it's Socrates' memoir. And I said, of course I would. Of course, I'd love to do that. And I translated the book. And unfortunately, it never came out for a couple of reasons. One of which was that there was rights issues that he never resolved. And the second was, it was just not really in a state to be published in English, because there was too much philosophy, there was too much history, it was a wee bit rambling at that point. There wasn't really enough about games and players, and really anyone in my mind who is going to read a book about Socrates is first and foremost is interested in football. He's interested in players, he's interested in games, he's interested in World Cups. I spoke to Socrates at that point and said, listen, let's try and resolve these issues with your publisher. And let's sit down, you and I, and we'll talk about games, and you can tell me about, you know, things that the games that you went through, goals you scored, players you dealt with, managers that you had run-ins with, all this kind of stuff. And he said, yeah, fine, okay. And as often happens in life, one thing leads to another, you forget it, doesn't happen for whatever reason. And in 2011, Socrates passed away, and we had just never got round to it. So then it was always in my mind that Socrates was this man who really needed a biography because of his role, in, particularly in the 1982 team, but also because at this point I was much more aware of the importance of Corinthians democracy. I was much more aware of who he was as a man, what he had got up to, how important he was in the whole transition to democracy. And as a kind of lone, kind of that lone footballer that was interested in more than just football. And so 2014, I started writing the book. I wrote the proposal. There was interest from publishers, and that's where it started. I just got going at the end of 2014, and the book came out in 2016. And 2017, came out in March 2017. And that's it. That really takes us up to today. So, you know, I'll be happy to answer any questions that I can about the book or the or Socrates or anything you want.
Wonderful. Thank you, Andrew. I do have, if I can just lead off with one question or two questions within one. You know, your personal relationship with Socrates comes through in the book, and you obviously have connections with a lot of his family. And it seems that one of the essential tensions that runs throughout, there are two tensions for me that run throughout. One is that Socrates was perhaps not the person you wanted to be married to, and was not perhaps the most loyal of fathers or partners, but also a tremendously influential public figure. And so uncovering the unsavory elements of his life while maintaining a sympathy for him seems to be a very difficult task in representing someone that you had a relationship with. So that's one tension that I see in the book. Another one is that in writing about footballers, we want to know about the games and the goals and the locker room and the conflicts on the field or in the football business, but that's only a small part of their lives. And it seems that you did a masterful job of negotiating those two narratives. And I was wondering if you could just tell us a little bit about how you approached the negotiation of those tensions and if you are satisfied personally with the way that they came out in the book.
Yeah, these are two good questions to start with. The issue of Socrates as kind of an unsavory person in some ways, you said, you know, he wasn't loyal. That's true, but for me, it was a very straightforward question for me because I came at this as a journalist and as a contrarian, and you know, you will understand, you know, what it's like to be a contrarian, and probably better than anyone. And so there was never any doubt in my mind that I had to portray him, warts and all. I know that you read most football books, and a lot of them tend to be maybe too admiring. Some of them border on the hagiographies, particularly the old ones and particularly the official ones. But even a lot of the newer biographies, I think they're written by fans. And it was very important to me to write this not as a fan. I mean, I'm not a Corinthians fan in particular. Nothing against them or nothing for them. I don't have any particular team in Brazil. So I didn't come from that point of view. And so it was just never an issue. I was going to tell the truth. That did create some problems for me, but the problems it's really created for me have come after. And this falls into your second question. One of the things that's most surprised me about the response to the book has been that people say to me, we put the book down, you know, we were loving it, we really love Socrates, you know, we love what he did, we love him as a player, we love, you know, his activism. But at the end of the book, we think, geez, what an asshole. Or, I didn't like him at the end, I came away not liking him. It's been a bit of a surprise to me. Maybe that's because I dealt with the issue for such a long time that it was no longer a surprise. But I think what happened is that people they knew the player, they knew how great he was, and that's the reason they bought the book. They also had an inkling of the activism, and they read that at the start of the book or in the middle of the book, and they learn about all that. But the real, you know, the decline and the problems he had at the end, and some of the issues, you know, where he basically drunk himself into an early death, where he kind of let himself down, and I think a lot of people also felt let down at his behavior. And I think because that's new to a lot of people, and I think because it's also at the end of the book, that's the last thing that's in people's minds when they put the book down. I think that's really what people come away with, and it's been a bit of a disappointment. I did try and change that a little bit, or at least nullify that a little bit with my epilogue, which is maybe the most elegiac part of the book, where I talk about his last, you know, his last day, where people are at the cemetery, you know, cheering him and singing songs and, you know, really celebrating his life. And also at the other, on the same day, almost at the exact same time of the day, on the other side of the state, fans are celebrating his life at a Corinthians match, where Corinthians needed to avoid loss to win the league, and they did. And so I tried to nullify that a little bit, but I don't think it was quite enough. I think people have come away with this semi-negative opinion of him at the end, which is a bit disappointing.
Have you had a different reaction from Brazilians that are not Corinthian fans versus Corinthian fans? And then, I guess related to that, people who are not Brazilians reading the book, have you noticed a difference in their reactions or their reading of the book?
Not really, for the main reason, I think, that it's not available in Portuguese yet. So anyone who's reading the book right now is reading it in English, and I think that implies, if they speak English, it generally implies that they have they're a little bit more international, a little bit more worldly. And it's kind of one of my, I'm aware that if the book does come out in Portuguese, then there will be more questions from, you know, the way I portray Socrates and the way I portray Corinthians and the way I portray Brazilian football, to people going, you said he scored in the 32nd minute in this game in 1989, when really he scored in the 31st minute. You know, so I'm aware that there's going to be a whole different reaction if and when it comes out in Brazil, and I'm kind of steeling myself for that if and when it happens.
You might want to be on holiday for that. Yeah. Okay, Roger Gilson has a question from Hartford, Connecticut.
West Hartford, Connecticut.
West Hartford, yes. Sorry, yeah, there's
a... Andrew, first of all, congratulations. It's a really wonderful book. I had a good time rereading it this week, and remembering the Scottish perspective you bring to it, and the links between certain goals and later matches, Brazil, Scotland, and so forth. I enjoy that. Seriously, though, I do. I think that the beauty of the book really is that you provide such a great context to the, you know, Socrates as activist, the figure that everybody who knows him knows that image, and really the way that you portray him as sort of coming to his political consciousness is fantastic. I guess my question is, and by the way, I also think that the epilogue really does undo some of the negativity that is you had to include about the end of his life, because it was just tragic, and a lot of parallels there also to Garrincha. I'd forgotten you translated that book, by the way. But I wanted to know about a little bit about how you made some of your interpretive calls, like on his time at Fiorentina, for example, that which is really fascinating. And there's just a lot more in here than I had seen in any other source. But I guess I just wanted to know sort of how you, you know, came to your line of analysis on that kind of episode.
Thanks, Roger, thank you particularly for those nice comments from somebody who knows Brazilian football every bit as well as I do, if not more. And I have your book, and it's great. And so, thank you. Again, this is a very simple answer for me, because I come at this as a journalist and, you know, not as an academic. So, I mean, I went to Fiorentina for a week, and I had a fixer there. It was the only fixer I used. And it was an Italian guy who has covered Fiorentina for decades. And he put me in touch with a bunch of players. And we went around and we spoke to those players and I just interviewed them and I got as much as I could from them. And, that combined with, reading, the source material from here, whether that be newspapers or magazines or whatever. I mean, it was all just me doing the reporting and seeing what everyone says. There was really no more complicated than that. Also, of course, speaking to people who knew him in Brazil. A really interesting person was the late now. He died last year. Was his psychoanalyst who visited him in Italy and spoke to him in Italy and really, said that there's two or three people who were really willing to say things that other people were not willing to say. And I think just getting to these people, that makes a huge difference. Footballers are not, in my experience, people who are going to open up about anything. I mean, there's a real clear unwritten code that what goes on in the dressing room, never leaves the dressing room. And so when you get a couple of people, like this, Casagrande, who's now a well-known commentator here, he spoke to me and he was very honest. And this Flavio Gicovacci, the psychoanalyst, he was also very honest and he said things about Socrates in Italy that no one had ever said. So it's just that. It's talking to as many people as you possibly can and just drawing your conclusions.
If I could just follow that up, because Gicovacci is actually, I have a connection, a family connection to Gicovacci too, and never met him in person, but talked to him on the phone. And I wondered if he talked to you at all about sort of just about Socrates, psychoanalytically, because one thing that comes through in this, and again, is there's a bit of a parallel to Garrincha's tragic trajectory, is a sense of, that footballers don't ever really need to grow up, which is, of course, the stereotype. But, even somebody who seems like such a politically, in the end, a political, sophisticated person as Socrates really, seems never to really fully accept adulthood in some way. However, whatever the hell that means, but I wonder if you got any of that from Gicovacci or anybody else.
Not in any great detail. I mean, I never even tried to, psychoanalyze Socrates in that way, and I never really, it never occurred to me to get into the whole psychology of it. I mean, for me, it was just much simpler than that. It's going and just ask him what he thought and get his opinion of him. And Gicovacci does in many ways. He does talk about Socrates as, I'm trying to find the passage in the book here, but he does talk about Socrates as being somebody, who considered himself not worthy of this model that he was going out with. He said that it wasn't so much Socrates not being able to grow up, it was more that he considered himself this certain type of guy. He was married to this woman who had known all his life. You didn't want to let her down, which is kind of admirable in one way. But Gicovacci says, and again, I can't quite find the quote here. Here it is. I mean, it says, when he went to Florence, it was almost as if he was running away from the whole Rosemary situation. He was, he says that Socrates was self-destructive. I mean, all that kind of stuff it was fantastic for me because people just don't usually say those kind of things about other people, particularly about the heroes. Yeah. So it was a huge advantage getting him. And again, one of the things that that really helped me in the book was the help of a guy called Juca Kafuri, who I mentioned several times in the book. Juca opened lots of doors for me because Juca, for anybody who doesn't know, he's like the dean of Brazilian journalists. He's like the ethical voice, the moral voice, and has been for a long time. And I actually went to see Gicovacci. He was given a... Gicovacci used to give talks on talks on psychology and psychoanalysis every week, and I thought it was kind of, a lot of it was like self-help mumbo jumbo in my opinion, but I went along to try and meet him at one of his talks he gave once a week, and he was very cold. I said to him, you know, can we talk? I'm doing this book. And he went, yeah, send me an email. And I did send him an email. He never responded. And he was quite clearly not interested. But then he got sick. And then, his health was going downhill. And Zhuka knew him. Zhuka was friendly with him from way back when they were, involved in Democracy of Corinthiana. And Zhuka reached out to him and said, well, you talk to this guy. This guy is serious. And Zhuka did that on several occasions. And it was a great help. And Zhuka actually said, yeah, I'll talk to him. And I went around, and I think on two separate occasions I met with Zhuka Fatshe. The advantage was just, as I said, was he was the kind of guy who was going to look at things, A, from a very honest point of view and say things that most people weren't going to say. And B, he was very interesting because he's not a footballer. So he comes at everything from a whole different angle, which was, again, really, really useful.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you, Roger. And I believe Peter is up next. Peter, the floor is yours.
Andrew, I really enjoyed the book. I only got it a few days ago, and I devoured it in just a couple of days. I love the way in which you depict Socrates as a three-dimensional figure. You know, I had read a lot, including Roger's work and Chris and others, seen movies about him, but I feel like I really know him for good or ill much better after reading your biography. And I remember growing up in Italy, you know, that season with Fiorentina was a huge letdown. Yeah. I mean, for those of us who were teenagers compulsively obsessed with the game, it was the golden age of Falcao and Platini and Maradona. And now Socrates arrives, and, you know, we're like, hey, it doesn't get any better than this. And he really was a kind of, he kind of sleepwalked, shall we say, through the season. And a lot of the negative stereotypes actually that endure in Italy about Brazilian players have a lot to do with that particular season, the particular timing of that moment, you know, because Falcao had done miracles in Rome, had won the title in 82, 83. Then Socrates had scored against Zoff in the great game at the Sarriá in 82. And yeah, we were just miffed. How could a player of such extraordinary, visible, tangible talent fizzle in that way? And so it was a great chapter, and the comments from Galli and Celeste Pin and all those guys, hey, you know, congratulations, really, really explained a lot. But I have so many questions, but the one I want to ask you right now is has to do with the manuscript, with Socrates' autobiography or memoir. You mentioned it in your opening remarks, and was it Churchill who said all biographies are lies? He would have known. So can you tell me more about working with that kind of a source? And here's the historian in me, of course, talking. I mean, what was that? You said the manuscript was a bit scattered and rambling. I imagine he was, you know, it sort of fits the man in a way. But what was it like for you? How did you incorporate it into the book? Because there's passages where you open the paragraph with the quotation marks, and you get Socrates' voice, very, very interesting insights. And then your voice comes in, and then maybe you bring another interview in, and then a page later, you're back to, you know, the voice that comes from the manuscript, from the man himself. And related to that, how did the family, if they were involved in any way, this very extended family, kind of deal with the fact that you were becoming his bard, in a sense, his
right.
Did you have issues with the kind of, sort of lowlights of his personal life or, you know, other aspects of his career? So one, working with the source of this wonderful manuscript, and B, sort of, you know, how did his family interact with you or respond to your work? Thank you.
Thank you, Peter. Two interesting questions. The first one of the manuscript is, you know, I think the manuscript, it's played up a little bit on the jacket, and, you know, the publisher plays it up because I think it gives them more of a, you know, it just makes it seem like a more of an authorized version. It just, it gives the book a boost, I think, in lots of people's eyes when you say we have the unpublished memoir. Really, though, there was something that was much, 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 much more important than the manuscript, and I'll tell you about that in a second. I didn't really use that much of the manuscript at all for two reasons. One, as I said, there wasn't really that much interesting in it, either about, you know, games and managers and personalities. And there really wasn't that much interesting in it about things like Democracia Corinthiana. He did have some stuff in it, but it wasn't all particularly new to me. He didn't make huge insights that I really wasn't aware of. So that was one reason for not using a lot of the manuscript. The other thing was that throughout the whole, almost the whole writing of this book, I was kind of on walking on eggshells. And this gets into the second question as well, because I didn't know if I was going to have the authorization to use bits of the manuscript. What happened with the manuscript was, let me take a quick step back. When I first proposed the book, the first thing I did is, you know, I spoke to Juca. He said, great idea. I went to Gustavo, who is Socrates' son, who's also involved in football. He was at the time the director of football for Sao Paulo. And I said to him, listen, you know, I'm going to write this book about your father. I'd love to have your participation. You know, can you help me? And Gustavo was quite, he was non-committal, shall we say. So I told him I was doing it. You know, I said I wanted his help. And then I said, listen, I'm not going to pressure you. You let me know if you can help. And he never really got back to me. So what I did at this point was that I went through Juca. I started doing the interviews. You know, I talked to people in Ruben Alpreto, and one of my great sources was Socrates' best man at his wedding. Another great source was two colleagues of his, or two student friends of his, and they told me a lot about the family. They told me a lot about his early period. Now, I didn't really know the family that well until we got further into the book, until we got probably into two-thirds into the reporting. Then I made contact with a couple of his brothers. And they were basically on board with the book. They were very helpful. So once I had the brothers, once I had their support, that made things a lot easier. The problem was that there was a legal battle going on between the family and Socrates' widow. And one of the things that was in, you know, that the court were arguing over was who would get the rights to use his biography. So I had to kind of dance around both sides. And that was one of the toughest things, was just, I didn't want to take sides. I know there was a lot of bad feeling on both sides. And so I really tried very hard not to take a side. It was just as simple as that. So I never used very much of the manuscript, as I said. What I did use and was much more important to me was Juca back in, I think it was 1999. It's never really explicit, but I worked it out. It must be about 1999. He sat down with Socrates and he said, we were going to write a biography together. We sat down for hours and hours and hours. We did all these interviews and it never happened for several reasons. First of all, he kind of laughingly said, you know, he would tell me something and I would go away and write about it in my weekly column. And then, you know, it was no longer, you know, the bomba that they wanted for the book. And he said, you know, the other thing was that, Juca said, I'm his friend. A lot of the things he told me throughout his life and a lot of things I witnessed throughout his life, I witnessed as his friend, not as a journalist. So Juca said, I was in this dilemma. If I don't tell these stories in a biography, I'm betraying the reader. If I do, I'm betraying Socrates. And he said, the easiest solution for me was just not to do the biography. Because Juca also knew that to tell the full story, you had to tell, you know, what he called los podres, you know, the bad stuff, the rotten stuff. Now, Hugo told me at the very start that he had done these interviews with Socrates, and I never asked him for them because I thought, listen, just bide your time. If he trusts you, he'll give you them. And that's exactly what happened. After a while, you know, I talked to Hugo on a regular basis. I would let him read some of the chapters to get some feedback. And there came a certain point where he said, listen, he just sat me down and said, listen, here's the written transcript of all these interviews. And it was 160 pages. And that, more than anything, gave me insights into what Socrates was thinking at the big moments in his life, what he thought about the people in his life. You know, it was just a whole new world into him. And I would guess that, you know, without that, the book was going to be probably 90,000 words, and with it, it came up to, you know, over 100,000, just because it enabled me to tell little stories because I had Socrates' explanation behind them. And a good example of that is how I think Hugo asked him about a despedida, if he wanted like a farewell game, like a testimonial, and he said, no, you know, I've never wanted a testimonial. All I ever wanted was just like to get all my friends together and we have a big barbecue, we kick a ball around and we drink lots of beer, you know? And that was a way, you know, by using just that, those couple of paragraphs of quotes, I could get in, you know, how he never had a testimonial or a farewell game, but also how, you know, how Brazilians usually have farewell games. So I talk a little bit about Romário and Rogério Ceni and all that kind of stuff. And there were several examples of him giving that little insight into something. Another good example was he said 10 of the best days of his career was the 10 days at the end of 1982 where they played four games against semi-final against Palmeiras and then final against Sao Paulo, and he scored a goal in each game. And he said, you know, that was probably the best moment of my career, or at least one of the best moments, because it all came together for me. It was democracy was happening. You know, my family life was okay, and I had just met this new woman at the same time. I was in love, you know, all the things together. And when that's the kind of thing that, you know, people rarely say in interviews. They rarely come out and say these things on TV or in interviews. They only really say these things with people they trust. And that was the big advantage, I think, for me in the book, was getting those interviews. It wasn't really using the manuscript per se.
Great. Thank you very much.
Yeah, Andrew. Thank you, Peter. And Alex is up next with a question.
Thank you. And thank you, Andrew, for joining us. I really enjoyed the book. I had a question also about the manuscript that you've just gone into great detail with, so I'll skip over that one. But I really was paying very close attention to Socrates' disputes with Mateus, the manager at Corinthians, the called president at Corinthians, Idi Amin was the nickname. And it reminded me of several club presidents who I've studied in Buenos Aires. There were some parallels, there were some differences, but I was really keyed in on the memoir portions in that section too, because you get Socrates' own words about what was kind of at stake in that conflict and how we saw that still in this liminal period where, he had just been transferred from Botafogo and had not really transitioned out of the medical vision of his future at that point. So it was fascinating to read about that in the detail that you were able to provide. And now you've given us more context on how you were seeing the memoir versus a lot of these earlier years. You've got some great quotes, and a lot of the narrative is driven by clippings from the sports press. So I was wondering, that level of detail with the club side of his career in these early years, it kind of is jarring with his time with the Brazilian national team, and I'm wondering if it's because of sources, because I forget, I think it's either a few pages after or 10 or 15 pages after, all of a sudden he's captain of the Brazilian national team. And you've heard about him, you know, playing for the national team a few times at this point in the book. But are there parts of the book am I right in that this is a portion you had less sources on or less interviews people we played with on the team, like, you know, the trajectory of him becoming famous at Corinthians is very clear, but the trajectory of him rising to the captaincy in Brazil is not as rich as say the 1982 World Cup. So am I right about that? And if so, or if not, are there other portions of the book where you had a particular like density of sources that you rarely were kind of rewriting sections on how you wanted to craft it versus others where you're saying, well, you know, I've only got so much, so I'm kind of going to go through this in a few paragraphs.
Thanks, Alex. That's something I've never really thought about, so you put me on the spot here. My first instinct is just to say that in the period between, the footballing period when he arrived at Corinthians, simply, to me anyway, just wasn't that interesting. He took his time to bed in, you know, they won the title in the 1979 Paulista, which they won, this being Brazil, in 1980. But from the end of 78 all through 79, you know, even 1980, yeah, you're probably right, there wasn't as much in it about the football for the simple fact that I just didn't find it as interesting. There wasn't very many layers to it. And that was always what was interesting to me as the biographer was finding an additional layer to the football. Just saying, you know, who won and when and how was never really that interesting to me. So I think really, you know, that's the main thing because, you know, also, you know, joining Brazil, I mean, a lot of readers outside Brazil, I think for an international audience, most people will remember 82 and 86 and they want to know a little bit more about Brazil. So I think that's probably also a little bit of a factor that's also in there too. Density of sources, that's also a question that I've never really thought about. One thing maybe, and this is again just me thinking out loud, I think there's probably more, it's easier to see and find games, full games and better highlights from YouTube from the 1980s than it is from the 1970s. That's probably, you know, one factor that tied in with the fact that I just didn't think it was quite as an interesting period. But, density of sources, you know, it was all kind of very level, very regular. Well, one thing that I really found interesting is that, you know, in my daily reporting now and over the last few years, I mean, it's almost impossible to talk to footballers. I mean, I did think about doing a second book after Socrates, and so I wanted to get in touch with footballers, Latin American footballers who played in Europe or had played in Europe, were now back in Brazil or Argentina. And I sent out emails or went through the clubs, went through the PR people where I could have got their agents, and I talked to maybe 15. I sent out requests to maybe 15 players, and only one responded. It was just so difficult to actually talk to players. No. And the one player that I did talk to, we spoke for half an hour or 45 minutes, and he really said absolutely nothing that was of interest. And I think when it comes to sources, when you go back and try and talk to players from the 70s and 80s, I think part of it, you know, they're quite easy to talk to. And I think maybe part of it is they like to be remembered. You know, I mean, even guys like, you know, Leandro, Oscar, Sergio Chulapa, almost all the Brazilian team from 82, they all spoke to me bar one, and the only one that never spoke was Eder. But when you try and talk to people from Botafogo, from Corinthians, if you can get their number, if people can track them down, they almost all speak to you. And I think they just, you know, they like talking about football, they like to be remembered, they like perhaps basking for a little bit in this glow of, you know, this great man. And I think that's also another factor that made it a little bit easier for me, because I was talking to players who had been a little bit forgotten because it had been a long time. One thing just before we go to the next question is going back to Peter's question about the manuscript. The manuscript is now available publicly. It has just been published by Socrates' widow in almost its exact form that he wrote it 15 years ago. She has added a few things. She's spoken to people like Ronaldo, Neto, who's a well-known TV presenter here now, who played for Corinthians, a couple of other Corinthians players, a guy called Toquinho, who's a well-known singer-songwriter here. She's added interviews with people speaking about the importance of Socrates to them. But by and large, the book is the manuscript. So it is available in Brazil now to buy at bookshops.
All right, thanks very much for those responses. We have Peter, and then Roger, and then Sean. So Peter, floor is yours.
Roger, maybe I can annoy you and bother you and ask you to get me a copy of that book next time you go to Brazil. I'd love to put that side by side, of course in Portuguese, so you know, it'd be difficult to use with my students, but we can talk about that later. So my question is this. So whenever you get very close to celebrities, you find out things that you probably don't want to find out, and that you wish you hadn't found out. And I think this is true of musicians, it's true of, you know, football players, it's true of artists, etc. And I wasn't so surprised about the contradictions. We all have those. But, you know, he comes across in your book, Andrew, as more of a libertarian, really, than a sort of, you know, social democrat, or, you know, let alone a radical. And I think the context in which he was living, you know, obviously radicalized that message and you know, has bequeathed us an image of somebody who maybe wasn't as to the left as we had assumed. The fact that he embraces commercialism is also interesting, while he's, you know, sort of taking a rather purist approach in other ways. But my question to you is this question of addiction in football, which now, you know, is maybe not so connected to alcohol as much as prescription drugs and the like. I mean, it's apparently becoming very serious, but not talked about much. We've had suicides, of course, in the last few years. I don't understand this. So George Best was a humble man, came from working class Belfast. He's sort of a stereotypical tragic figure. Garrincha obviously came from nothing. You know, also died of cirrhosis. You know, it looks like Gascoigne is headed that way, sadly enough. There have been other cases. Socrates was a medical doctor. And you say at the end, like on page 343, how, you know, in the last years of his life, he's basically doing nothing but drinking. And he shrugs off any concerns that doctors and friends and family have about what you say is the visibly awful and worsening health. I think you say something like he was impervious to logic and common sense. And I just couldn't understand that at all. And if you could help me with that, like how can a medical doctor, someone trained in the scientific method, you know, fail to see this and not like to go see doctors, apparently, among other things. And if that surprised you, or if there are other discoveries about the person that really shocked you. Thank you.
Peter, I simply don't know the answer to that question, and I don't think that anybody does. It really makes no sense why somebody who'd studied medicine all his life, you know, continued to do this to his body. And one of his student friends, who's now a well-known hematologist in Ribeirão Preto, you know, I put this question to him, and he said, his answer was, you know, he just didn't think it would happen to him, which is not a great answer, but it's really the best answer we have. The only other alternative answer I have is just for, he didn't give a toss. You know, he was going to live life, you know, his way. And that was it, you know, bugger the consequences. And in many ways, I mean, that when you put that, you know, next to his life, it kind of makes sense in many ways, because, you know, Socrates tried all through his life to his force of personality. He tried to bend, you know, clubs and countries, you know, fans. He tried to bend their will. And it was almost as if he was doing the same thing with alcohol, you know, as if he thought that, you know, by force of will, by force of personality, that he would beat this. But, you know, to me, I don't think he really thought like that. I just think he just never considered it. I just thought he was going to drink. He was having a good time. That was the way he enjoyed himself, and that's what he was going to do. And I think really that's the answer. It's interesting you call him a libertarian, and I think that's as good a description of him as anything. To me, you describe him in one word, it's libertarian or it's contrarian. That was the other thing. You know, if you said black, he'd say white. He never necessarily thought white if you said black, but he enjoyed an argument and he would argue that because it challenged him and it stimulated him to get into an argument about everything. So, you know, that's the way he was.
Okay. Thank you very much. Roger is up next with a question, and then Sean Stein.
Okay, just a couple of quick ones, Andrew. I mean, the bigger question is how you've lived in São Paulo that long without having a team, but that's for perhaps a different conversation. But small ones. So first of all, you do touch on this. I just wanted to hear a bit more, if you have anything, about his relationships with the Torcidas Organizadas, and because, you know, Corinthians is famous for having some of the most active, shall we say, of those ultras. And then also just how you dealt with the complexity of his, you know, his romantic life. I mean, you mentioned the widow. I assume that means Hygina.
Widow, his Katia Bagnarelli, his final wife.
Okay. Yes. Okay. So, because there's a lot of stuff there, and I thought you handled it really well, because it, you know, it's stuff that has to be in there. But clearly, you know, I mean, I certainly didn't want it to be the center of the narrative, and it's not. But it's there's enough of it to fill out that part of his personality, part of his life, and it really does add to the overall picture. I wondered how you manage that, and you know, as you also said in relation to the manuscript that. You know, some of these people are still around, and you know, it's difficult, as Rui Castro found out with his Garrincha book when it first came out.
Yeah, I mean, that's how do you manage that is very carefully. I mean, there was really only two people that I really wanted to speak to, two key people in his life that I never got to speak to. One of them was Regina, his first wife. The other one was Gilson Montero Alves, who I've since been in touch with, and you know, he kind of apologized. He was going through personal issues and said, that was why I never spoke to you. And if he wants to speak, want to speak to him now, he will. But his romantic life, yeah. I mean, I got in touch with them all. Some of them were more willing to talk than others. They all had their own vision of, you know, what went on. One of the remarkable things is, they all still seem to have a huge amount of tenderness for him. You know, one of them, you know, broke down in tears talking to me, obviously still in love with him. And another one calls me, even today, occasionally she'll send me WhatsApp messages, you know, asking me how the book's going, or, you know, how it's being received, and, you know, what people are talking about her. So, you know, and you know, I think he was one of these guys who just had a huge personality and people loved him, for all his faults. Your other questions, the relationship with Torcida Organizada. You know, at the time, I think his relationship with the Torcida Organizada has changed. You know, when he got there, I don't think he realized how important the Torcida Organizada was at Corinthians. It was just so much bigger, you know, and so much stronger than it was anywhere he'd ever seen, particularly, obviously, at Botafogo. It was a whole new thing. Of course, he was at, you know, kind of at the peak of his powers, or coming to the peak of his powers. And as I said earlier, you know, he felt like he was going to be, it was him against them. It was like this battle of wills, and he was going to, you know, force the Torcida into changing rather than him changing. And that really created a real, when they started winning, you know, that combined with the whole democracy of Corinjana thing, which was, which, you know, can't be understated, he created this bond with the Torcida. And in his later life, I think that worked against him because he had this kind of naive opinion that the Torcida Organizada, you know, if you could, he used to say, if you get the Torcida Organizada, you know, organized for a good cause, you know, they could change Brazil. You know, conveniently ignoring the fact that Torcidas Organizadas in Brazil are, in many ways, they're almost like criminal organizations. I mean, a friend of mine wrote a Swedish friend wrote a book about Brazilian football, and it's called Jogo Bonito. And he wrote a chapter on Corinthians, and he went with the Gaviões, the Fiel. He went to a Corinthians match, and, you know, it started off, he's on the bus with them, and, you know, they have a few drinks, and they're teasing him because he's Swedish and they're, you know, they're Brazilian. And, you know, then it goes from drink to drugs, and then they start, you know, abusing him almost. They get to the game, which is outside in the theater in Sao Paulo. They jump off the bus, basically beat up this ticket guy, take all his tickets, beat up this guy selling beer, take all his beer. You know, and they're hooligans. They're nothing more than hooligans. And Socrates conveniently ignored this because he had already created this, you know, bond with the Torcida Organizada. And I think that's important to stress, that relationship really changed. You had one other question other than...
Oh, no, the other one was just how you don't have a team in Brazil, in Sao Paulo.
Well, I do have a team in Sao Paulo. My team is Hibernia, the greatest team in Scotland. But when Brazilians ask me, who do you support in Brazil? I always say Hibs, and it always really flummoxes them. Because, I've gotten to this argument with a friend of mine who wrote this big long piece for Blizzard about how he came to Brazil, fell in love with Santa Cruz, yeah. You know, and became a big Santa Cruz fan, and I argue that you can't feel the same way appropriating a team like that you can if you supported a team from childhood that your father took you, or you know your brother took you. I think it's a whole different thing, and it's an argument for a bar with lots of beer. It's a great argument for a bar with lots of beer, but I have my team. There's some teams I always simpatizo with some teams. I kind of have soft spots for some teams, particularly the ones that play attacking football and good football. And I won't go into them because this has been recorded and it might be held against me at a later date.
It will definitely be held against you, no question. Good. Thank you, Roger. Thanks, Andrew, for the answer. And now we'll move on to Sean's question. Sean?
I think you have to unmute your mic, Sean.
Okay, sorry. I think I got it here. Can you hear me?
Yep.
All right, sorry. I was having some technical difficulties there. All right, Andrew, had a bunch of things I want to say about the book, but I actually want to pick up on the last thing you were saying there. I know you said it's a conversation for a bar, but it was really resonating with me. My experiences in Brazil are always very awkward when I tell people that I don't have a team at all. And I've played my whole life and I'm a product of Yankee football, in that I really was unaware of global football till the late 90s, quite frankly. My first real recollection of a World Cup game was ironically Scotland-Brazil. I was watching it in a pub in Cusco.
I was there.
You were at the game.
I was at the game, yeah.
Yes. I remember there was me and one Peruvian who were rooting for Brazil. Everyone else was expat rooting for Scotland, and it was an amazing experience. But it is an odd thing to not have a team. I in Brazil even, right? And I completely know what you're talking about with simpatizar. It is important. My questions here, if I can ask just two. One, quickly, you know, you've talked about the unpublished translation of the memoir. And I'm really keen to try to find some of his own writing in English that I can use in class. And I'm wondering if any of his crónicas have been published. I know that Juca has the collection of crónicas, but I have not seen any of them translated. So if you've translated any of them or anything, I'd be very interested. And then the other question, I guess, is a little more contemporary, and I'm just wondering, you know, he passed not too long before the Confederations Cup and the revival of protest in Brazil. And, you know, it's really been interesting to see it make its way into sport. You know, during the Olympics, the Fora Temer signs appearing on screen, and people being removed from events because of protest. Just wondering about his own awareness of his impact, not just on protest, I guess, you know, also collective bargaining, just his impact on the world of sport and politics in this case.
That's an interesting question. His awareness of his impact. Mm-hmm. It's a good question. I don't really know the answer to that. He knew. I would guess he knew his voice was important because he knew that he was speaking up for fans, for ordinary fans, for people who really, he was speaking truth to power. You know, he was speaking out against the CBF, he was speaking out against the World Cup because he knew it would be a big, you know, corruption fest. You know, so, you know, he knew that he was saying things that not a lot of people, you know, said, or at least certainly people in his position, former footballers, were saying, because while he was saying this, you had your Cafus and your Bebetos, you know, grinning like, you know, grinning up there on the dais beside Jerome Valk and, you know, Sepp Blatter. But I think he also realised that it wasn't going to have that much of an influence. I think he realised at this point that he had no influence. His influence was to be the bomb thrower from outside. I think that's probably the best answer I can give you.
Okay, I'm sorry to interject. I just want to make sure what I was interested in is the sort of the legacy of his political activism. So not necessarily at the time period, but just in his later years, if he had a sense of that.
His legacy in football?
Protest in sport or in football, yes.
Sorry, I don't really understand your question.
So I'm wanting to know if he had a sense of, I guess his the persona. So he's a reference. He's a global reference for political protest in sport, and I'm wondering if he had a sense of that. That's all.
Do you mean from way back with...
In 2000, no. So that's what I'm trying to say. 2010, 2000, in latter years.
Sorry, again, you're asking, was he aware in 2010 that people were still talking about Corinthians democracy and that what he did back then was influential?
Yes, and that that he was inspiring new generations.
I don't know if he was inspiring new generations because I don't really think... You know, there have been new generations, and I think that was one of his biggest disappointments, is that he fought so hard for players to have more rights and for players to have a say in the running of their club, and it's basically never, ever been repeated.
Right.
And I think that was a huge disappointment to him. And one of the most interesting stories for me in the whole book was him going to... Cabo Frio as a manager in 1999, and you know you probably read this, but you know in the book he goes to the club, you know he becomes a manager, And really, he's doing this as much for the whole democracy changing people's minds as for getting involved in football again. So he sets up this stuff with the club. They get a little room under the stand, and he makes the players every day, they pin something to the board, whether it's a page from the newspaper, or he makes them talk about a film or a book or something like that. And after, once it started to go quite well, they were engaged, the players he felt were engaged. So he said, okay, we're going to take this one step further. We're going to ask the players if they want to give up the Concentração. And he said there was 41 people at the club. And he said, we voted on whether to give up the Concentração, and 40 people voted against, and 40 people voted against, and one voted to give it up. And mine was the only vote to give it up. And he told this story. I only heard the story for the first time. I don't think he'd ever told it before, because he told it in an interview, one of the last interviews before he died, on a well-known Brazilian talk show. And it's great to look at his face, because he tells this story, so sheepishly. And it's as if he's saying, that battle that I fought, 20 years before, it came to nothing. It was worthless. The players 20 years later were just not interested. And I think that, and I know that really saddened them. Mm-hmm. One other thing, just talking about, you talk about, his influence. Let me just say, there's just yesterday, you've probably seen in the news, this a black city council woman was killed in Rio last week, Mariela Franco. And she was a Flamengo fan. And Flamengo fans made a big banner in her honor. And they were first refused permission to take it into the ground. And then Flamengo got involved with the police, and the police said, yeah, you can take it in. They took it into the stadium, and it was taken down for reasons that, are still a little bit unclear. Apparently someone said it was because it was, it was blocking the view of people below. But it's kind of, that to me is, it really tells the story of football, modern football. You make a banner in tribute to some woman who's been killed by, for standing up for LGBT, for blacks, for, for women. And you're not allowed to take it into the stadium, or you have troubles taking it into the stadium. And that's tragic. There was another similar situation a few years ago now, probably 3, 4, 5 years ago now, where the same people at Corinthians who took a banner into the stadium, and I think it was in 1979, that called for an end to dictatorship, they wanted to repeat that exact experience 25 years later, I think it was. I'd need to check. But they weren't allowed to get into the ground with the same banner from 20 years previously. And so it just shows you that, in many ways, I think we've gone backwards, or it's every bit as hard, if not harder, to make public protests at football matches. Mm-hmm. Sorry, and one other thing that I wanted to add, you asked about the memoir. There is also a book in Portuguese of his collected columns, or selected columns, from Carta Capital, the left-wing news magazine.
Right. Thank you.
Thank you. I think we'll just go on to Andrew Guest, and then I will have a final wrap-up question.
Yeah, thanks. It's fun to hear the discussion. I'm somebody who doesn't know a lot about Brazilian football, so I have had that stereotypic understanding of Socrates just in terms of the activism and things, and so to get the more complex story is interesting. It was interesting actually to hear you say earlier too that you didn't want to get too into the psychology of him in relation to the latter question of why he ignored all the evidence about the drinking. I mean, I kind of thought the end of the book was suggesting that, ironically, for somebody who's associated with activism and political engagement, that he really was floundering for a sense of purpose, and he felt a real absence of purpose and meaning in his life. I mean, I guess I am a psychologist, so I'm looking for that, but it seemed like that to me was the irony of the explanation. He's this icon of activism and engagement, yet he in his later life just felt an absence. He was flat, like he was trying all these different things to find some sense of meaning, but wasn't finding it. So I don't, that's partially a comment, but I'd be curious if that feels fair. But I guess my quick question, which is actually kind of a silly question, but I thought the preface to the book by Cruyff was funny, partially just because he just comes off as kind of arrogant and mean, and he just sort of says Socrates was a shame, and he was dumb for thinking that soccer should go to 9v9. So I was just sort of curious about that in terms of the framing. Do you think that Cruyff had some real insight, or is it just to get his name there as well? But
yeah, I think, like I said earlier on, with the getting on the cover, the fact that this is unpublished parts of his own memoir, I think the Cruyff, in many ways, it's a similar thing with the Cruyff preface. Particularly Cruyff had died, not long before, so I think it really was as much about, publicity as anything else. I got the Cruyff preface from his widow. His widow had kindly allowed me to use it. She's used it, I think, in her new book as well, the publication of his memoir. But it was more, I think, to get Cruyff on the cover, and just because they're two iconic figures, in many ways they do go together. I mean, Cruyff and Socrates. But I didn't really think that his preface really added that much. I thought the first half of the preface made sense. I kind of felt he rambled a little bit at the end. And if I had had the chance to sit down with Cruyff, there would have been a lot more I would have asked him about Socrates, and a lot more that I would have wanted him to talk about. On your first question, he's you're right. He did flounder for a purpose in life, and I think as a youngster, Socrates had this. He had his life kind of mapped out for him. He was going to be a doctor, then decided to be a footballer, and was going to be the doctor after being the footballer. He did that, and his life went. He had a great time, and when the medicine center Socrates Medicine Center that he opened, when that didn't work out, he was disillusioned with medicine. He was disillusioned with the way it worked. And I think once those twin crutches of that he had had all his life of football and medicine were taken away from him, then I think he stumbled. And I think really that was a tragedy of his last years, is that A, he never really found anything to replace them, and B, that led him into this downward spiral.
Great, thank you. Well, these questions have been fantastic, and thank you for the thoughtful answers, Andrew. And I'll just take, if I can, the moderator's pardon and ask one last question that we can finish up on.
Sure.
And it's a little bit of a complex question. I'm not sure exactly how it's going to come out of my mouth, but it seems like in football, and especially in Brazilian football today, the only thing that we're really left with are anti-heroes, whether it's Romario and his flip-flopping politics and his self-serving Senate campaigns, or now Ronaldinho Gaúcho stinting for Bolsonaro in the far right, or the feckless consumerism of Neymar and his showmanship, etc. Would it be possible for Socrates to fulfill a role as a rebel democracy, pro-democracy figure in today's football landscape, or has it changed so much? Have the politics and economics of global football shifted to the point where Socrates would not even be selected for the national team or for even the Corinthians first team if he were to hold the positions today that he held in the 80s? And with that, is there then room for the politicization of footballers of the stature of Socrates, either in Brazilian football or on the global scene?
Yeah, good question, Chris. I think that it would be harder for a Socrates to get into the first team you know, I think if people realized maybe he was a rebel and he had all these opinions, that might create some problems for him when he was young. I think once he'd broken through and once he'd proven he could do it on the pitch, I think that would make it a lot easier for him. I also think that it's obviously much harder for people to be to take these positions today. I think you can take positions. I definitely think you can take positions, and I think there's absolutely nothing stopping people taking positions. I think the problem is it's almost impossible for us not to be accused of being hypocrites today, because you know we're all consumers. You know, if we're going to fight against consumerism or one side of politics, you know, you can always be tripped up. Everybody can find a way to trip you up, especially with social media. And that would be one of the big problems that any footballer is facing today. And, you know, I spoke to, after Jadson and Felipe Melo spoke out in favor of Bolsonaro, who's this like right-wing lunatic demagogue in Brazil that's running neck and neck is in the lead for president. They spoke out in favour of him very briefly, and I spoke to Joe, who played at Corinthians alongside Jadson, and said, why are you guys doing this? Do you speak about this in the dressing room? You're from Corinthians. You know the history of democracy of Corinthians. You know, you're black. You came from from a poor black background. You know, his uncle had gone to jail for drug trafficking. You know, his brother was killed in a car accident. Why aren't you speaking out about this stuff? And he said, listen, we speak about this in the dressing room, but we know the moment we put anything on social media is we are going to get massacred. And, you know, there's a certain, they might have a certain sympathy with him. My answer to them, though, is quite straightforward, is you don't have to be Socrates. You know, first of all, Socrates was an exception. And I think that's something that we forget. I think we forget how absolutely remarkable he was in taking positions about stuff. You can count on one hand the number of people who've had such a number of football players who've had such an influence socially and politically in their countries. But you don't have to be Socrates. All you need to do is take half an hour to watch the news every day or read the newspaper every morning. That's really all it takes. And you know, you might get hammered for it, but if you come out with an intelligent, you know, and coherent position, then you know, that's great. That's really important. As for, you know, your Romarios and your Ronaldinhos and your Neymars, again, you know, I mean, somebody wrote a piece and it came out in Jacobin a few months ago about Ronaldinho, you know, and his, you know, flirtation with Bolsonaro. And the piece is very good, apart from the first line, which said there's no two stranger bedfellows than Ronaldinho and Jair Bolsonaro. And I read that and I thought, why do you think that? Why? What makes you think that Ronaldinho is not aligned politically with Bolsonaro? And I think that's a question that we should ask when we talk about heroes and anti-heroes. There is absolutely nothing for me to suggest that most football players, other than their backgrounds, and you can grow out of a background as a lot of them do, there's nothing to suggest that they are progressive or left-wing or have the good of the community or the good of the fans or the good of the public in general, you know, on their minds. I think they're young and daft and are interested in, you know, being a success and, you know, driving a nice car and, you know, getting nice girlfriends and all that kind of stuff. And I think that's something that we often forget. So I'm not at all surprised that Ronaldinho has signed up for a right-wing party, and it wouldn't surprise me if we see others, especially in a country like Brazil where ideology is, you know, almost non-existent.
Yeah, wonderful. Thank you. That's a very curmudgeonly perspective that I fully appreciate. Thanks very much. Well, I'd love to have a round warm of applause if I can. Thank you, Andrew, for taking the time to speak with the Football Scholars Forum. Thank you to Peter and Alex for hosting, as ever. And I will turn over the final words to Peter, who will tell us about what's coming next.
All right. Thank you, Chris,
did a very nice job of moderating the forum. I think this is a format that worked, and we're going to repeat it next. Let's see, I'm looking for the date here. In April, we're going to have a session with Laurent Dubois, professor at Duke University, and we're going to read his new book, The Language of the Game, How to Understand Soccer. And it's April 26th, 3 p.m. U.S. Eastern Time with Laurent, who's been a member of the Football Scholars Forum for a long, long time, since 2010, in fact. So please join us and RSVP to Alex. There's information on the website, and we're going to post the show notes, so to speak, and the audio on the website as well in the very near future. So thanks very much, Andrew, for a great book and for excellent conversation. And thanks, Chris, for doing such a good job moderating. Really appreciate it. And everyone for participating.
Thank you very much for having me. And, you know, really appreciated the chance to talk. And maybe we'll do it again after my next book, if ever that happens.
Excellent.
Thank you.
Thanks, Andrew.
All right. Peace.
Take care.